We've all heard the story of what happened on February 7, 2009, Black Saturday. You know the numbers and have seen the photos, images that have left lasting impressions on us, the public, who could only feel for those trapped in the path of the inferno that day. Across the next 40 minutes, through their words, six women take you on the journey they experienced not only on the day of the fires, but also what followed in the days, weeks, months, and even years after. It's thanks to these women sharing their stories that you and I can get an insight into some of the things to expect if we find ourselves in a situation that generates similar outcomes. The immediate needs of the individual and those of the affected community. Or how as a bystander we can truly help anyone who experiences trauma in any form or at any level. Six women, each from different backgrounds, each with a different story, but one thing in common. They have risen together from the ashes of Black Saturday.
My story from the 7th of February, an interesting day. I got up in the morning and thought, oh, what a great day. Get some washing done today. Threw a load on, hung it out and came back in and thought, nah, it's just far too hot out there. I said, I won't be doing any more washing.
From the outset of the first day, Black Saturday, we were in preparation, got the fire station sorted and set up on the off chance that if a fire did start, we'd be well organised.
On the day of the fire, things didn't go to plan. Our plan is that I leave with the old dog because I'm kind of old like the dog and not built for fighting fires, but to prepare first. So to have everything around the property prepared, all how you would have the generator ready, the fire hoses ready, all of the preps. We didn't actually know the fire was coming, and I relied too much on the CFA website and I would listen to the radio. Now, I noticed a plume of smoke at midday, roughly, and I'd said to my husband, it was so distant, it was like a volcano in the distance, a plume going up. And I'd said to my husband, we've got a fire.
I don't know, 2:30 in the afternoon, we got the first call, went out and it was just a false alarm. We knew that there was something happening over Kilmore Eastway.
Thought I'd better just check the CFA website to see what was going on, and that was when the fire was first reported in Kilmore. And I thought, Kilmore's miles away, you don't have to worry about that.
Coming up through Whittlesea, I was very aware of the fire in Kilmore and I'd been listening to ABC. Driving up the mountain to King Lake. I didn't drive into any fire or smoke or anything like that. I was probably about 1.8, 2 kilometres up the mountain, and then all of a sudden, literally, on my left-hand side, fire just erupted. And within that, you know, time frame, I thought, oh dear, I'm not driving into this. I don't know what I'm driving into.
Dave called me at work and said, there's a bit of smoke around, don't come home. And at the end of that phone call, I heard someone yelling out to him. And it wasn't till weeks later that I realised that person yelling out was his dad telling him to run for his life. We had no contact for a number of hours, and he was sitting in the dam with his mum and dad and brother waiting for the first fire front to go over. And it was at that point I rang him and we had a brief conversation, and he got the chance to tell me where he was and what was going on, and then the phone cut out.
You know, my records showed that I tried to phone my husband about 4:15, I think, in the afternoon. And I have recollection of saying, I love you, sweetheart. I can't come up. I'm a bit stuck at the moment. I didn't say anything about being stuck in the fire. I can't get through. It's coming. It's coming.
And I mean, the wind from that fire was just phenomenal. I was actually at the back of the fire station and it blew me over. I ended up on the ground when it changed and that fire front came through.
And we'd said to my eldest daughter, stay on the phone until someone answers. Just wave to us out the window if you can when you get through to someone. That must have happened because I heard my daughter on the phone saying to someone, if you come looking in this house, there are six people. And I thought, she thinks we're going to die. And my husband came in pretty distressed at that time and said, I can't do it anymore. I just
and he was nearly passing out and having an asthma attack. And I just pushed him back out.
So I was trying to contact my family on the mountain, knowing my nine-year-old would probably be on her own in the house. We were very lucky. Most of King Lake by that stage was cut off, the telephone lines. We didn't, for some reason. We had telephone lines, and I'm so grateful we did, because over the next 3 or so hours, I had a lot of contact with my daughter. I was giving her instructions. Okay, Chloe, this is what you have to do next. Go and get the water bottles. Can you see Daddy? No, don't worry about it. Dad's probably on the other side of the house. You can't see him at the moment. I think I lost it at one stage, and when she said to me very calmly, Mummy, what do I do when I see Daddy on fire? And at that stage, I think I took a deep breath and said something like, well, sweetheart, tell him you love him, keep the door closed, and come away from the door and come and talk to me. I just thought, what do I say? What do you say to that? What do you say to a child?
So when people talk about survivors or having been through the fire, everybody's experiences were different. Doesn't matter whether you were here, whether you weren't. It was still not something that you would ever want to have to experience again. I think one of the great lessons that we've been able to learn from Black Saturday is that throwing money at people after a disaster is not necessarily the right way to go, because unfortunately, if you didn't have money pre-fires and you struggled to balance your weekly budget, you're going to have more problems if you're given a grant of $50,000 or $100,000, which is supposed to go back, you know, help you rebuild. Unfortunately, a lot of people saw that opportunity, being given such a huge sum of money, as an opportunity to buy that new car that they'd always wanted, or go on that, you know, holiday that they'd always dreamed about, and then only to come back home and go, I've got no money to rebuild my home. There needs to be supports to help people before they're given huge lump sums of money. You know, it's no different to somebody that wins Tats Lotto that 2 years later is broke. I know people that received their insurance money, bushfire appeal money, and have still not rebuilt their homes because they have no money left, purely because they've lived on the money that they were given for the past 2 or 3 years without working, without putting any money aside to rebuild, and they're in a worse position now than they were before.
The money that was given to assist everybody is also partly what divided the community and created a lot of issues, which sounds, how ungrateful does that sound? And that's what, you know, we all think when we say it out loud, that people that gave to assist would have no impact or understanding that that actually also created a few issues. And that was more around how the decisions were made to hand out the money and how soon to hand out the money. And when the media is driving a campaign to shed light on what's going on, which is fantastic, but to then also be pushing decisions to be made very early on about how money is handed out can be very dangerous. And in fact, I was talking to a lady from our hometown, talking about, imagine if only some of that money was held back and we could make good use of some of that money now for the things that our town and our community really needs. People assume that after a year that we're all back to normal. So the money that's handed out, hang on to it for a bit longer. Put a lot of it away. Don't give it all out in the early stages. And we're only a quarter into our recovery. The research tells us we're only a quarter into the recovery, and yet all the money's gone. And some of that money could really make a difference, not to rebuilding houses and rebuilding structures, but rebuilding people. And when you've got programs that aren't able to continue, that are making a significant impact on the emotional and mental health of not just kids and adults, but men and women and elderly people, and there's no money to keep it going, oh, if only we had some to keep a program going like that, that's making a real impact. So hang on to the money, give it out over a 10-year period, stagger the money, and don't be accountable to media, to community. If you know what you're doing, know what needs to happen, and hopefully you can funnel it through some sort of foundation set up within your community, rather than having it to be held by the government, who really want to get rid of it as quickly as they can. They want it off their hands so that they're not accountable or responsible for it. So if you haven't got a foundation set up within your community, get one started, so that if anything ever happens to your community, the money can be filtered through your foundation to be then handed out as your community sees fit over a course of time and not in the first few years. And that way, you can ensure that the mental and emotional health of your community is there long-term, not just short-term.
I would say probably at about the 2.5 year mark, the town and the community really started to implode. Volunteers were well and truly burnt out, and there weren't new volunteers coming in to step up, because people were so busy with their own lives, that whether they just finished rebuilding or they were just starting to think about it. But the underlying thing was, so because there was so much money involved, and whilst I was grateful for the huge outpouring of support from Victorians, Australians and internationally, at the end of the day, money breeds all sorts of dramas. There was people accusing each other of ripping off the system, and for people that were, you know, had volunteered, you know, hundreds and hundreds of hours to the community, to all of a sudden have their integrity questioned, it led for a really toxic environment for some people. And unfortunately, a lot of people in the community that were heavily involved in community groups have taken a step back and aren't involved in anything, or worst case scenarios have actually moved out of the area because they just couldn't deal with the constant sniping and having everything they did or everything they tried to do to help the community questioned.
People in the community who could help other people were not allowed to help other people because they were fire affected. Helping other people heals us. I've found that all of the voluntary work I've done since the fires, which is, I would do 30 hours of work helping people, this is what heals me. This is what heals people, is helping other people. Allow the community to help the community and assist the community where they need it. There were great donations like caravans, but red tape got in the way of that too. People just wanted to willingly loan a caravan or give a caravan in some cases, but the red tape sort of got in the way of a lot of that too. What would happen was, this is not suitable because it's got blah blah, and we could get sued if we sent a caravan with a rusted tow bar. It's going on a block. It was just silly. The red tape got in the way, and I know they were trying to protect people, but it got ridiculous. Just take the blinkers off for a minute and just relax. Everyone was so rigid in governmental things. It was so rigid. You had to fall into that guideline or that guideline. If you didn't, it's not written down. Can't do it. And there were so many people outside for honest reasons and good reasons outside those guidelines. And forcing them to adhere to them is a bit wrong, I think, when they're so desperately stressed.
The people that maybe were leading in your community before your incident, and in our town it was the fire, won't necessarily be the leaders after the event. We saw some people that had never put themselves forward in the community at all come forward and just quietly get on with doing their job. I'd say to you, for your own community, look for the people that maybe don't have the loudest voice, but actually are doing the stuff, and then go and speak to them. Listen to the people that have the loudest voice, but don't just listen to them. Look for the people that are also just quietly getting on with doing the job, and ask them what they're seeing. Ask them what they're hearing. Ask them what they are seeing the needs of their community are, and work with those answers. And that way you get a broad view of what's going on, rather than just maybe the people that are presenting as leaders. but you're getting a much broader view. And speak to the kids. Ask the kids what's going on. Ask the youth what their needs are, and that'll give you a broader view. Ask the people that aren't coming to the relief centres what they need. Get on the road, knock on the doors early on, and ask them, where are you at, what do you need? Don't wait till 2 years down the track to do a Red Cross door knock. People expected that to happen in the early days after the fires, and it just didn't happen. So get yourselves together, speak to the people that know the area, that know the streets, that know other people in the community, and work with them. Ask the questions. If you're not asking the right questions, you will not get the right answers. Ask who you're not seeing, and ask why you're not seeing them. Has their car been burnt out? Are they too traumatised to leave their home? Was the looting stopping people from leaving their home like it did for us in King Lake? People were too afraid to leave their home for fear of being robbed. So there's so many questions that can be asked. Don't just ask who is there, ask who isn't. And find those people, ask them the questions, and then you'll get the real answers.
Yeah, with the big cleanup, all well-intentioned, I know, but I know that a lot of people were not in the right frame of mind when they said, and I know of them personally, oh, I don't care, just take everything. And so the company assigned to clean up would just bulldoze the whole topsoil, everything. It was just like a scavenge. And then months and months later, people think, Dad's war medals were in that tin chest in the shed, or I left something really important in somewhere and that box was still okay. They should have really perhaps got a lot of containers and put anything that might be of value later in a container for them, or in a cage in a warehouse or something like that. I do know a lot of people that felt that they would like to have something and keep it.
We would be asked, people would say to me, you know, did your house burn down? And I would say, in a split second, so much would run through my mind. I would think, well, no, it didn't burn down, but oh, if you only knew the stuff that has happened to us since then, you wouldn't believe it.
And when you're dealing with all the emotions and everything that you're going through, the last thing you want is people asking you questions about what happened. I'll relay a story from my daughter who was working at the bakery at that time, and a woman, and sometimes I just don't think people think before they speak. She walked in, my daughter was 16 at the time, and she said to her, so how many of your friends died in the fire? You know, and you just think, what sort of a question is that to ask anybody, let alone a 16-year-old shop assistant, you know? So there were all those sorts of challenges. So not only did we lose our environment, we lost our quiet little sleepy town, you know, just out of the Melbourne suburbs where, you know, it was nice and tranquil. We all knew each other, got along really well, to this, you know, to being thrust into the media spotlight and becoming a tourist destination when we didn't have any infrastructure to support any of these people that were coming up.
For myself, at the 18-month mark, I had a complete breakdown. I was working full-time in a business. I was doing my work with Firefoxes, running our relief centre, still helping people in our community. I had a situation where we had a number of deaths in our family and friends, and some of them were very horrific and very traumatising. It came to the point where I was exhausted and I couldn't get back up. I had fallen over a couple of times and managed to keep going. And then I finally hit the wall, and that was the hardest thing that I've ever experienced in my life, because I didn't understand the feeling or the loneliness or the isolation within myself. And I pretty quickly realised, after wanting to eat endless amounts of hot chips and cans of Coke and chocolate and be driving around the city and tears just streaming down my face for no reason, that I realised there was something going on. And that D word crept into my thought, that word depression. And I'm a tough girl, and I always have been. So to be able to think that that was possibly what was affecting me was very confronting. But it also was interesting from the point of view that my background in health and alternative health suggested that my depression that was coming up was about the suppression of my emotions that I had been through. And so I had to face that, and I decided to face that head on. And that was to pretty much shut the rest of my world out, which was a very hard thing to do because I'd always been the fixer and the helper. So I shut everybody out pretty much and focused within and spent a lot of my time working on myself through emotional healing techniques to confront what I had to let come up naturally that I had pushed down, because I was alive. My husband was alive and my house hadn't burnt down. So I didn't really feel like I had the right to be in a situation that we'd been traumatised. And that was why I was where I was at. If I had realised earlier that I was in fact traumatised and looked after myself better, I would have been far healthier mentally and not be in that position that I was.
It's a lonely process when you're going through that crash and burn, particularly if you're not used to talking about your emotions to people that you don't know. And it can be even really difficult talking to family members because you don't want to upset them. You know, you know that they're dealing with their own stuff, so you tend to try and deal with things yourself, and then sometimes it just gets to the point where that's it. Your brain just explodes and you do not function. Getting out of bed, even though you can't sleep, is an effort. You know, everything is an effort. Making a decision over white bread or brown bread is like whether to go to war or not. You know, it seems that big a deal and you can't deal with the normal things. You know, I had a stack of envelopes that were my mail for about 4 months and I hadn't opened a single letter, a bill, because it was just too much. I couldn't deal with those everyday life choices and life decisions that you make. And we probably went for almost 18 months, 2 years before we actually got into a normal routine at home of what I used to do, go out and do the shopping and actually be able to prepare meals.
So if you were saying to someone who's just going through this again, if they know from the moment the incident happens that they will never be back to normal.
They will never be back to normal.
You are decreasing that expectation to be aiming to be back to normal. After your event, don't expect to be back to normal. And if anyone tells you you're going to be, ignore them because they don't know what it's like. We thought in a year.
Yeah, we'll be back to normal.
Everything will be rebuilt, we'll be back to normal.
Yeah. No, there is no normal. And the it's year, a new normal.
Exactly. And the year anniversary came around. Can you remember what that was like?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That first year anniversary, thinking that we should have all been back to normal by then. Can you remember the lull that happened after the first year anniversary?
Yeah.
Those few months where it was like we all realised
it was not going to be the same.
You just need to be busy. And I don't know whether everybody experienced that, but I felt that I just kept taking on more and more. I couldn't sleep. So to stop myself thinking about what had happened and being able to reflect, it was just, if I keep myself busy doing whatever I'm doing, then that's the good thing. That's how I dealt with it. The only problem was I didn't spend any time with my family because they were okay. We had a home. There were so many people that didn't, so I didn't have time for them. And reflecting now, I think, hell, I actually should have stopped and spent some time with my family after the fires rather than running around, you know, getting over-involved in everything just so that I could deal with things, you know. And maybe that was my coping mechanism, and if I hadn't done that, things might be different now.
So listen to what I'm saying to you, and that is recognise early on, no matter what the event is, no matter whether you're alive, whether you have lost people in your family or your friends, whether you've lost your house or you haven't, just living through it is traumatic. And it's okay. It's okay to say that. We have this Aussie trait that we're all tough and we don't want to admit defeat or acknowledge that we aren't doing okay. Because we laugh about in King Lake, we say, if we heard one more time, she'll be right, mate. She'll be right. that was the going thing. And we knew that we would be okay, but it was still okay to say, this has been a really shit time and it's pretty confronting and it's changed my life forever. And it will It will be forever different, and that's okay, because there's a secret about surviving a disaster. And that secret is, the sooner you understand that your life will never go back to what it was, the better off you'll be. But when you realise that your life will be different and it will be okay, and what you knew as normal will be now a new normal, and that's okay, then that's when you can move through it. I can very proudly sit here and say that I faced moving through all the depression and the anxiety and the worry and all the things that I was carrying, faced it head on. It was the toughest and scariest thing I've ever done in my life. And I would do it all again exactly the same way, because I've come out of it trusting that it would just work out, and it has. And I'm better for it today, and so is my husband, and so are my friends, and so are my family, because I'm still me, I'm just a different kind of me, and that's okay. If you are sitting at home and you hear about a disaster that happens in your backyard, in your community, anywhere in Australia, do me a favour. Do not go and clear out your wardrobe. We need to change the process of how we do this. What you are better off doing is going to your neighbours, knocking on their door, getting a few bucks from everybody, and you are better off going down to any of the stores and buying, if it's just one thing, if it's one brand new t-shirt, one brand new pair of undies, one brand new pair of socks. Because after running the relief centre in my backyard for those weeks and seeing people who were coming in who had nothing left, they had one thing that they still had, and that was their dignity. And having to cycle through dirty clothes or ruined things, and look, most of it was pretty good, but even so, it was still stuff that was not theirs.
Just the basics would be great. Don't send used undies. That did happen. There were boxes of used undies.
And to put on after wearing, you know, clothes for the same few days, because that smells like smoke and they've been burnt and damaged, to be able to go in and pick up a clean, brand new pair of undies, clean, brand new t-shirt, I cannot tell you what that would mean to people. So don't clear out your cupboard. Go and buy one thing brand new and somehow get it up to the town that needs it. That will have a greater impact than clearing out the stuff that you don't wear anymore, or you don't like anymore, or that you haven't gone around to taking down to the Selvos. One brand new thing is all you need to do, and you've contributed.
As far as wanting to help, and I get it, I totally get it. I did the same thing when the floods happened in Queensland. I wanted to help. But before I did that, because of our experiences, I knew not what not to do and what to do. So I actually rang them and asked. So if you want to help, that's probably one of the first things. If you can actually get in contact with somebody, if you know somebody in the area, ring and ask.
The basics, looking back, if you're a person who wanted to give things to a relief centre, just stop and think about what would you do if you had nothing? What do you need? Towels, sanitary products, dog food, batteries. If people have got no power, torches. Just think of yourself. What would I need if everything's gone? My clothes are gone, shoes. You know, just have a think about what you would be without today. And it might be something as simple as a toothbrush and toothpaste. It might be nappies. Nappies are an important thing. But it's mainly thinking about what people would do when they have no roof over their head.
My personal experience, I have quite a number of friends and observed quite a few single parent families who were obviously trying to navigate all the various agencies and get the aid that they required and look after the kids and, you know, make sure the kids had their basic needs looked after, but they were also trying to make decisions on their own and didn't necessarily have the support of people close to them or who were able to offer, you know, advice. And one of the issues that, you know, was identified to me, and then I sort of went, oh, how did I not see that? Single parents often don't have that headspace. They don't have that time to even have 5 minutes peace to think, to read through things, you know, to go through their insurance contracts, to actually sit down, compose themselves and get started on anything. I know, you know, many friends who had said, all I needed was half a day to get my head around something, but they didn't have that. So childcare, you know, there's no respite when you're a single parent. If you don't have family support or ongoing and continued respite, where's the headspace to even begin to navigate any of this?
One of the best initiatives in the aftermath of the fire, which was probably a lot longer down the track than it should have come, was the wellness vouchers, which came into effect, I think, from memory, and still my memory is not great on a lot of things, but I think it was about 18 months down the track, which allowed people to use not necessarily alternate therapies, but complementary therapies to help them get through. So rather than just going to the doctor and being given antidepressant tablets and being told to come back in a month, it would have been great to have had these wellness vouchers, which would allow you to go and have a massage or see a kinesiologist, have a, you know, visit a Reiki therapist or EFT therapist, all these alternative therapies that have now in the lot, you know, we've found that for a lot of people it's been the alternative therapies away from mainstream Western medicine that's actually got them through. So my advice would be is to look at using, you know, massage. I think it's the downtime that come with these therapies too, and the more holistic approach. It's not just treating something with a tablet. It's that whole body, mind and spirit together and working on healing you as a whole person rather than just giving you a tablet that's going to help your brain chemicals.
Slowing down, it's attending to the things that really need urgent attention. Housing people, getting roofs over their heads, getting injuries treated, feeding, clothing, water, all of the things, looking after fences to keep livestock in, that was a big thing. Yes, fast, immediate things. But dealing with the people, when you ask them what they want, give them time. You're really a bit stuffed in the head. Yeah, it's hard to think of everything rationally at the time because you've never gone through this before. And treat people a little more gently. The healing and the well-being aspect, after those emergency crisis things, that's the thing to deal with, is the getting that adrenaline level down. Because most people had their adrenaline up for so long, some still have a problem with that.
Our town experienced something that we assumed that after the fires, we assumed that this secret agency from nowhere would come in and save the day and put everything back together and really get things back on track. And I guess we were a bit naive. We thought that would happen and it didn't. So we've learned a really valuable lesson in knowing that if anything was to ever happen in our town again, or if anything was to happen in your town or any town, that if we could share one piece of advice, it would be to be prepared to be on your own for 5 days. Expect nobody to come and help you for 5 days. We did have some help, but not in the order that we thought it would be. So get your stuff ready, know your plan, have your line of communication with your neighbours and your community open, know who maybe some of your first responders are within your town, have enough equipment, have enough gear, have enough food and water and fuel to get by for 5 days. Because we live in the lucky country, but to have a town with no water and no food and no fuel for 5 days, you can't imagine it. So if you've got that, you will be a long way ahead in your recovery because you are self-sustainable in responding to whatever hits your town.
So if you were saying to someone who's just gone through a flood or a cyclone or a trauma of any kind around that level of expectation of being back to normal, what would you say to them?
Don't expect it. It's just not going to happen.
It's just,
go with the flow, look to the future.
You'd have to inspire yourself. You have to do things for yourself.
Like you talk about, remember how you talked about how different you were after the fire? Things that you never used to do that you...
Oh,
Like not the what? Same person.
Yeah.
I used to be, you know, I used to lull. I used to just, you know, sit on a couch and eat potato chips and do, you know, okay, what goes? Normal things every day. Get up, go to work, come home, do this, do that, clean the house, cook tea, sit down. That
the was usual normal. Mundane it wasn't, stuff.
It was just that normal thing that you did. It wasn't anything extraordinary. It wasn't anything
who cares
different.
If there's a bit of dust lying around now? Mate, go out and do what you've got to do.
Do. So yeah. After the fire, that sort of stuff for you?
It's
is that a conscious thought?
I don't know about a conscious thought. I guess it would be. But it's more, I think for me it was, people always used to say to me, life's too short. I never got it. Oh, I'll get
until
it now.
Until then.
But do you think people are capable of getting that if they haven't been through a disaster or a trauma or a life-changing experience, no matter what it is?
No. You have to have gone through it. Like, you know, your close friend could go through it and you could be with your close friend. You're still not going to get it.
No.
You have to actually go through it.
Yeah.
And that's when you get it. Life is too short and you will have to go out and do what you need to do and want to do for yourself. No one else is going to do it for you at all.
Did you ever have the thought previous to the fires around things like, always wanted to do this, or I wish I had done this, and you started to find yourself then not questioning or thinking about, I'll do it, I'll do it next week. You'll just do it.
I did that straight after the fires. Yeah. I was not going to sit on the couch anymore. I was going to do what I want to do.
So can you imagine then if your life had gone back to normal after the fires? Like, you know, that whole thing about we'll go back to normal. Can you imagine your life being like that, back to normal?
No, not now. I wouldn't let it go back to that, I guess.
Why?
Because you look back on it now, there's so much more I can do.
Right.
And there's
so much
a lot
more you will do.
Yeah, and there's, I don't want to do that anymore. Because I don't. I want to do this. I want to better myself. I want to do better things for myself. I want to do things with myself. It's creating something for us to achieve too. It's just like, you know, I did Kokoda. We went to Peru last year and we climbed more mountains. We climbed up to 4,600 metres.
That was just like,
we're doing
you
hikes
have even
and
about.
We're doing four peaks. I mean, God, we didn't get out of our house to do
a
walk up
crazy.
The street. You know, we're doing four peaks. We're doing Mount Mystic Mountain, Mount Feathertop, Mount Hotham, Mount Buffalo.
So it's raised the benchmark for you in life almost to some point.
For me, yes.
Yeah.
You've chosen that avenue. Whereas
yes.
Maybe people haven't chosen that way. You've chosen it to raise.
Yes. I won't go back to
normal.
The old normal.
The old normal.
And the other thing you find too is, you know, not that I get along with lots of people and I love lots of people, but you find that you make friends and you'll stick to the friends or the people that are an
inspiration
to you.
Like
the people who drag you down and are misery and are still in that place, which is fine for them, but it's not for me. I can't actually hang around them. Because
you gravitate towards what's positive.
What's
and
positive, absolutely. There's only one way out and that's up.
Up.
I want to go backwards.
Yeah.
And that's upsetting for me to see people still in that state.
Yeah.
But that's their choice if they don't want to move on.
Yeah.
But I will always, always help them if they need help.
Yeah, absolutely.
I cannot not help them. I will always help them if they need help. And I always try and inspire. But it's their choice
that's
and
it.
It's the way they're thinking.
That's it.
So day seven to somebody who's just gone through a trauma with that expectation of going back to normal, would you say to them that imagine what your new normal could possibly
could
be?
Absolutely. Oh,
wish I knew more about this too.
Mate, I wish I'd have known it 20 odd years ago.
Look, it is... It opens up everything for you if you let it.
That's right.
If you don't let it, it won't.
It's how you perceive it.
Yeah.
You know? Endless possibilities out there. There's so many different tangents and ways you can go.
So would you say that your confidence has grown as a result of
knowing? I have. Oh,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
I don't take crap from anyone. I know I used to hide under a rock.
Absolutely. No one believes me. I used to be shy once upon a time, but yeah, I was.
Me too.